Some of them over-exhilarated, some of them definitely destructive. The individual, having lost control of himself, falls back on what the Buddhists call the not-self, the illusion, the delusion which most people believe to be themselves. Actually, consequently, they must recognize that the narcotics problem is aggravated and made worldwide because of economic factors, and thousands, millions of people are dealing in narcotics, perfectly aware of the fact that they are destroying human life, and they're perfectly willing to destroy life for the sake of money, and quite willing, finally, to steal and commit a whole variety of crimes in order to get the price of narcotics. All this is adding to practically every crime of society. But there is no one who has to become a narcotic addict. No one has to try it the first time. No one has to continue to use it, fully aware when they do continue to use it that they are wrecking themselves. This is largely due to a search inside of the person to find out why he should live. He's also probably tried to answer that question himself, but he cannot find within himself any reason to change his ways. He cannot see what he would be any better off if he did not become an addict, because the world as it is around him is as delusional, dangerous, and discouraging as anything that could possibly result from his intemperances. He therefore ends up with the idea of a short life and a bright one. But even this fails, because very few narcotic addicts ever get out of this world without great misery. So all problems go back again to what we might call a karmic situation. Every impulse within the person to a negative or destructive action is the pressure of a mistake or a blind spot or a corruption not corrected within himself. The individual who cannot withstand the pressures of temptation has not withstood them in the past, therefore has paid many times and is now paying again, but is given an opportunity this time to correct his own faults. Faults that we allow to become apparent to our conscious thinking are here because they are offering an opportunity for the correction of themselves. We are not here to humor our faults. We are here to overcome them. Every fault overcome is the end of a karmic pressure. And a karmic pressure which we have brought with us may contain within it the whole sad history of the human race, far much further back than we realize. We come into this world unstable, incapable of clear judgment, but we are here to gain stability and to clarify and improve judgment. It is only when we do these things that our life becomes important. Today, there are not the proper inducements, apparently, to inspire the individual to make these changes in himself. Actually, how many people really respect their own lives? How many really say that their life is important to them? Certainly, they do not want to leave here before their time, most of them at least, but the number of suicides is increasing dramatically because of the fact that this world, as it is now, is not giving the individual the incentives of survival. In karmic terms is this: we are in an environment in which there is no inducement to improve ourselves. There are inducements to be more wealthy, there are inducements to physical pleasures or excesses, but in terms of growth, there are very few inducements for the individual to be a better person tomorrow than he is today. All the inducements are clouded. All the indulgences stand out as possible temporary solutions to problems for which a real solution is not available. So So this world as it is a great inducement to leave karma uncorrected. And one of the ways in which we can do this is to have our minds taken away from our own faults and shortcomings. Instead of saying to ourselves, let's forget the whole thing and go out and have a night on the town, it might be wiser for all concerned for the individual to say to himself, let's try to work out something here that will make life important, useful. And one way we have found in the past that many people have found to be helpful was service, to get out to help other people, to get our minds off of ourselves, to try to do the good deed as the final panacea for the ills we have already committed. Actually, we are here with all these faults, some of which we have to do some thought and remedial means. We have to work them out. If we to destroy the thinking equipment, if we make it possible for the mind to lose track of values, if we obstruct and obscure the lesson factor in the things that happen to us, we just get more and more miserable and sicken and finally die. If the mind can lead, it can help. But if the mind loses the power of leadership and gives it over to the intensities of a drug, then the problem is out of hand. We have destroyed the rationalizing faculty in ourselves, or inhibited it and impaired it. To do this means inevitably that we become a burden upon ourselves and others. We get worse and worse, unless something happens strong enough and powerful enough to bring us back again in line. But then again, there's another difficulty. If the narcotics habit extends long enough, recovery is almost impossible. The damage that has been done to the nervous system, the damage that has been done to the magnetic fields of the body, cannot be quickly repaired. And the person, though they may recover from the habit, will not be the person they should have been had they not developed the habit in the first place. Now, how can we try to work out this thing a little more successfully? Let's try to make a little formula out of it. First of all, let us assume that every human being is here to learn something. He is here to correct faults, to strengthen ideals, to gather and accumulate facts, to become wiser and better and finally happier, because there is no actual happiness apart from growth. Any individual who tries to be happy by evading or avoiding responsibility is making a basic mistake. Therefore, assuming that we are here to do something worthwhile, this next problem comes in, of course, is to preparing ourselves for this worthwhile activity. Normally, parents who really care for their children will do what they can to help them in this orientation. In the older days, when life was much simpler, it was customary for children to follow in the trades and professions of their elders. The shoemaker's son became a shoemaker. The sailor's son went to sea. The minister's son became a preacher. These were the common procedures of the time, and the parent constantly gave what he could of his own experience to advance the cause of his children. He tried to help them to be the persons that they could be, or at least he thinks they could be. All this made a more or less secure situation, in a sense. It might have frustrated some personal ambitions, but they were not very strong at that time, at best. The individual was brought up within a pattern in which education began by example and was cultivated by a family that sincerely had affection for him and was given every possible opportunity to fulfill a useful career. This was equally true of both men and women. Today, this has practically changed. There is no longer this type of thing. The apprenticeship in the family is very, very unlikely. Positions and employments of mature persons are impermanent, insecure, and usually unpleasant. Therefore, each has to start and build a complete career without benefit of parental guidance or parental assistance or assistance through the educational structure. So each person has to work it out for himself. Now, if he can reach a certain age, say around 20, without being completely contaminated, he has a good chance of working out something worthwhile. He can be an individual and do his thing instead of being bound into something. I read in the paper not long ago that Walt Disney, on one occasion, told a friend that he was a grade school dropout. Disney had practically no formal education, but he did rather well because he did his thing. He did what he wanted to do. And he didn't depend upon schooling to obliterate or deform or distort his own feelings on these matters. And this is true in a great many instances. If the person can reach the time of decision in life without having this decision corrupted, he will probably be able to make a useful and important contribution to society. And education may help him. It may be able to give him a fuller understanding of practical ways of helping. Education may provide him with the instruments of service, which will be of value to him. But it is the instinct within himself to serve that must be preserved, or else the techniques are worse than useless, and will end again in exploitation. Having decided in some sense of the word and by some internal adjustment that the individual can be a person, an individual, in a society of mass calculations and collective pressures, he can then, as far as his daily life is concerned, do whatever is necessary to meet the responsibilities of living. The individual who finds a way of avoiding responsibility is in very bad way also, because this avoidance becomes habit-forming, and the person becomes a completely inadequate individual. But assuming that he is reasonably doing the things he is equipped to do, he can then build a life around whatever is necessary for his own growth. His job may take a certain percentage of his life, but a job will not destroy his inner life if it has vitality of its own. A job that destroys the inner life is a job in which the inner life was not strong enough to survive the pressure of outward circumstances. But if the individual within himself has character or conscience or integrity or has ideals or perhaps certain gifts and abilities which do not fit into his economic pattern, these things can be preserved, they can be developed, and if necessary, they can become the second careers after retirement. But there's no need for the idealism in the individual to die because of the materialism of his environment. He can survive it if he has anything inside of himself. He has the perfect power to be a person. He has the natural inalienable right to live and die according to principles. Now, if his principles are not adequate, if he has compromised them too much, then perhaps he will find that his mistakes will cost him heavily in freedom and in advancement. But if the person is as God created him, is a natural human being, bringing into this life unfinished business, both assets and liabilities, and always equipped to meet the day if he uses the equipment, he can have a very valuable life regardless of the pressure of circumstances. Under those conditions, he will have no need for the development of any narcotic habit. He will not need to escape from frustration because he has already inwardly strengthened his inner life so that he is doing in his own character what he really wants to do. And when this happens, the probabilities of drug addiction are greatly reduced. It is also true that if the person has a fixed vision from within his own consciousness of what is proper for him, he will not need to depend upon encouragement by bottled goods. He has the encouragement within his own life. He has his own way of growing. It is not necessary for him to block his memories. It's not necessary for him to refuse to express temperamental natures which are themselves constructive and reasonable. So we find that our narcotic problem is largely a result of too much vacuum inside of the person. Not enough basic value to meet the pressures of life. Now, life is going to have suffering. It's going to have problems. But these problems and these sufferings are apt to be significant, whereas the sufferings of narcotic addicts have only one remedial factor, and that is to prove to the individual that he is destroying himself. I think we have another very interesting point to make in connection with this problem of getting oneself in shape of some kind and in some way. Most people today who are interested in better things in life have a realization that there are esoteric factors in the human compound. We realize, for instance, that man lives not only in the visible world, but in an invisible environment. That this invisible environment, or the etheric diffusion in which the physical matter of life exists, is under the rulership of the lunar principle. And it is this principle by means of which the constant vacillation of energies and emotions and thoughts that this motion is maintained. In this also, according to the ancients, and perhaps they were right, who knows, this borderline between the objective and the subjective is also the sphere of ghosts. It is the sphere of beings that never had existence in the physical world, for there is no plane or stratum of nature that is not inhabited. It is also a place where, according to the ancients, earthbound spirits wandered about in all kinds of unpleasant conditions, where the individual who has been bound to some negative situation holds on to the situation after death and does not even know that he is dead. He continues to be the possessed or obsessed being that he was in life. Now, in this environment also, we have the source of a great deal of psychic phenomena. We are beginning to recognize that we can no longer throw away the possibility of psychic phenomena. We are no longer able to say that these metaphysical situations do not exist. Day after day, we get more supporting evidence that psychism is a reality. But we also get some rather unpleasant witnesses to the problem. We find out that most of this psychism is rather detrimental to our daily life. A psychic experience which is merely an embodiment of ambition may make us feel that we are too big for ordinary labors, that we have been given a special dispensation, and then we start off on a long program of self-illusion. And disillusionment comes later and is hard. But it is also true, beyond doubt, that the Greeks and Egyptians were partly correct, at least, when they pointed out that all forms of narcotics formed a connection between the physical body and the etheric realm in which it exists. That this was a strange realm of pressures, that these pressures could be thought forms, emotion forms, vibratory centers of energy, by which the individual is as though in a great ocean filled with living creatures of its own. As long as the magnetic field is maintained, as long as the protective armament, which is entailed in the Bible, the full armor of righteousness, is protected, and the individual is a reasonable person, not damaging his own psychic factors, he is in very little trouble. There is not one case in a million where a person who has lived a straight, upright, constructive life has unpleasant psychic experiences. They are reserved for persons who are already unpleasant somewhere inside themselves, and it's simply expressing its own nature. But in this psychic atmosphere of things, we know that there are all kinds of dreams and phantoms. And in these phantoms and these dreams have a tendency to make cowards of us all, as in the soliloquy of Hamlet. We are in the presence of an invisible realm from which we are marvelously and wonderfully protected because we have a particular job of our own to do. We are here to make an adjustment, to redeem our own world and redeem ourselves in that world. But if we, by negative means, create a negative psychism, if we break down the protecting barriers between this objective life and the strange, misty realms of the great unknown, we can get into very difficult situations. And this, of course, is one of the great problems of all forms of delusion through drugs. These delusions can be sometimes very frightful. The individual goes through all kinds of torments as a result of something that he doesn't understand. He has allowed himself to fall as a living creature into something that resembles the purgatorial realm of the ancients, this mysterious psychic field in which the physical life exists. It is very much a mistake to permit this psychic field to overwhelm us or drown us. This problem that is the same as being drowned in the ocean. If we cannot swim, we will sink. And if we are maybe a good yogi, maybe we will float. But then we will not win unless we know how to protect ourselves from self-deceit, protect ourselves from all kinds of psychic revelations that never work out, all kinds of damage which we imagine, but the damage is in the mind only. We surround ourselves with all kinds of mysteries and misfortunes, and the mind becomes to substance a haunted house. This problem does mean that the moment we lose psychic control of normalcy, we become the victims of all kinds of delusion and disillusion. We lose integration, we lose orientation, we lose the power to make proper decisions, and we finally find ourselves completely trapped in the mystery of sensation itself. Well, sensation is the emotional equivalent of mental psychism. Sensation is a part of the process that has been given to us to enable us to function the various sensory perceptions. Sensation gives us the power not to sit on a hot stove, because if we do, we will feel the burn and get up. Sensation gives us the right to sense motion, color, form, all kinds of relationships with life. It enables us to see, enables us to hear, to taste the food that we have, and to shake hands with our friend. Sensation is part of a great structure of communication processes, but it is also something that is the base of all appetites. Sensationalism is the belief fallacy, but still many times held, that some form of excitement is a solution for stupidity. That if we can get excited enough, worked up enough, and forget ourselves enough, we will be happy. This doesn't happen either, because there is always in these matters the morning after, and that is usually deadly. But sensation, again, getting out of hand as a result of psychic pressures, is exaggerated and amplified by narcotics. Narcotics, as such, affect the physical nature to a degree. But the main thing is they disturb the psychic vortices by which bodily function is maintained. In other words, they disarrange all of the autonomic nervous system. They cause the individual to become sick psychically as well as mentally or emotionally. The person simply loses control of his own life. And losing his own control of himself, he gradually reaches the point where he sacrifices the right to a life which he has lost control of. He's not supposed to float around on the surface of drug addiction. Unless he does something with his own life, nature decrees that the situation will end in dissolution. Nature will not support that which continuously breaks its own rules. There are times in medical cases where certain narcotics are necessary and useful. But as a means of escaping self, they are a deadly mistake. And yet that is why most people are using them. Now we are told, for instance, that the peer group is responsible for a considerable amount of drug addiction. That you have to be one with the group. That you must be accepted by others of your own age group. The peer group, in this case, is just a group of individuals supremely ignorant. The peer group has nothing to offer. The individual who tries to be popular by joining this group and making the mistakes they make is destroying himself in order to maintain a passing and very temporary social relationship. The peer group the child should learn is not that important. Education should steer the young person today away from all involvements in the peer group. Should reveal to him definitely that this group is not a superior group. It is a group of individuals held together by mass delinquencies, by continuing wrong addictions and attitudes. Away from the peer group, the individual is much safer. In a good family life, there is great protection against the peer groups. The church offers another type of peer group, which is essential and basically constructive. There are young people's activities that are clean and proper. But the young person must have some discrimination in order to become part of these better groups. And here the responsibility goes right straight back to the parents. Because unless the parents themselves become the final peer group, acceptable to their children, honored by their children, and respected by their children, the child is in trouble. Actually, we are in a kind of a peculiar process of epidemical ailments. All over the world, there is war. All over the world, there is suffering, privation, and tyranny. All through our lives, there is unemployment. There are all kinds of besetting problems. We don't know what to do with cosmic space waste. We don't even know what to do with the local sewerage. We do not know what to do with any of these things because they're all closing in on us. And closing in on us while we're in a little planet which has certain limitations that are inevitable. But this should never have happened. And because it has happened, the only thing we can do is to hope that a remedy can be found. Whilst we should be working every day to conserve and simplify life, we should get over the problem that luxury can become universal. It cannot. We should be also out of the situation in which we try to live a highly competitive economic life in a planet that's too small to permit it. All these things have to be taken into consideration. These are the problems of leadership. These are the things our educators should be working with. These are the things that our leaders and our governors and our industrial potentates ought to be concerned about. We cannot get away from misfortune until we stop causing it. And so long as we cause chaos, we're going to have narcotics addiction. There is no way of avoiding it. Because we have taken life and we have taken away from it those integrities and examples which are necessary to keep people honest. We are no longer in a condition to offer a human being a natural human opportunity to be a useful part of society. We are teaching him more and more not to do the things which would make him a well-adjusted citizen. We are keeping him under the delusion that he is part of something which probably will fall apart, because no one seems to believe it'll be otherwise, but that if it falls apart, he must be prepared to fall with it, because there are no remedies. This is absolute foolishness. There has never been a time when the remedies have not been available. And when these values are established, we will find that most people want to enjoy good health, happiness, and peace of mind. Actually, if we could watch psychologically or metaphysically the effects of various materials on the etheric and vital bodies, we would have something that's very close to the Paracelsian theory of medicine. We are told by Paracelsus and others of that period that food that we eat, we do not actually receive nourishment from the food per se. We receive nourishment from a vital element, invisible, that is present in all food. It is a universal life force that we try to capture, and we try to transmute food into energy, which we do only because we are releasing the energy that is in the food. Now, energies in foods differ. Some foods have more of one kind of energy, more of another. And body chemistry demands a balanced ration of these different food factors. And the great proof of alchemy is not the wisdom of the ancients, but the function of our own digestive system. We are transforming base metals into living principles every day of our lives. As it is with food, so it is with most other things we have. The education we get is a form of nutrition. It is not the education per se, but the energy of thought and initiative which it releases in us that is important. Here is where the alchemy takes place. Facts become truth by alchemy, the alchemy of insight, understanding, and capacity. The same is true in our emotional life. Our affections are not physically, actually, the cause of happiness. It is the higher vibrations or octaves of our feelings that become nutritional to enrich our lives, to enrich our relationships, and to become the basis of proper marital happiness. The same way with all of our thoughts and minds. It is the transmutation by an alchemy of understanding that lifts all things from a standpoint of dead fact to living truth. And this chemistry is going on constantly inside of ourselves. And it is this that does the good thing for us. But the wrong diet makes us sick. The wrong emotions make us unhappy. The wrong thoughts make us miserable. Therefore, if the food is wrong, it is not any good to us. And today, humanity, mentally, emotionally, psychologically, and religiously, is largely on a diet of junk food. It is not just the physical junk food. It is the fact that these junk foods destroy or fail to nourish the invisible energy fields with which they are involved. Having become sick with junk food, which in this case can be world propaganda, reports and rumors of war and disturbance, we do what everyone does who is sick. We try to combat the difficulty by a trip to the doctor. The doctor tells us that we need a little more vitamin, that we've got to cut down on this, that our cholesterol is too high, that our blood pressure is too high, that we are not getting enough calcium, that we're not getting enough this, that, and the other thing, and we go into a great nutritional routine. Perhaps it helps. It probably does. But let us also realize that psychologically, we cannot really depend upon drugs to take care of things that belong to the invisible levels of character. We are all suffering from the junk food of world as it is today. The news is junk. All these things are destructive. So we go now and we try to get something like cocaine or heroin or marijuana so that we won't notice the junk food, that we won't have to improve our diet because we don't really want to do that. But we do want to get rid of the unpleasant symptoms that have come from junk thought, junk emotion, junk conduct. Therefore, we try to get some kind of a panacea by means of which we will accomplish the most that can be accomplished, namely, that ultimately we will reach a point where we won't worry at all because there will be nothing to worry with. That will then be the problem of returning to a subhuman state and drifting into the inevitable end. This type of thing we don't have to do. It's perfectly possible for us to be rather intelligent creatures in one way or another if we really try hard. It's just a case of recognizing that all stimulants, alcohol, any other stimulant, is simply a substitute and a poor one for the stimulation of our own intelligence, for our own integrity, for our own wisdom and understanding and our own cheerful, useful activity in life. An enthusiastic person with a job, or one who is preparing for a job he likes, who is succeeding in the daily experiences of life, has no need for involvement in any form of narcotics or alcohol. He does not need to take a chance of any form of sickness arising from a bad habit. And all habits that seek to prevent the individual from thinking are bad habits, because he is here to think. The human being, as the Hindu says, is the embodiment of manas, the mental principle. It is the purpose of the individual to perfect the functions of the intellect, to cause the intellect to ascend to a more rarefied atmosphere and become the gateway leading into the spiritual world. It is through the mind that the individual can ascend to union with his own soul, with the best part of himself. And when he diseases this by an effort to avoid or evade growth, if he tries desperately not to be better, he can succeed in that too. But the cost is very high. It is much better for the person to realize that by keeping the channels of the nervous system, particularly the autonomic nervous system, and the function of the ductless glands, normal, constructive, and helpful, he will have the strength and resource to meet practically every problem of life. And any individual who doesn't want to grow, isn't willing to do a little worrying, and will not devote some time to self-improvement and to the service of others, such an individual is not entitled to any of the better things of life. But he doesn't have to react to the worst things in life. He may remain unadjusted to life. But now the temptation is to hide his inabilities from himself, to avoid contemplating his own mistakes. And then comes the narcotic addiction, and the person is in really serious condition. So let us really then be satisfied to enjoy our own mistakes. Let's recognize them as challenge. Let's know that we're not perfect and weren't intended to be at this particular time. But we are all here with the glorious possibility of learning something, becoming better, facing our problems intelligently, and staying awake to the world's work and the world's labor, and not trying to find some kind of a pill that'll put us to sleep while we're still alive. What we do not need is to sleep while we're alive. We are here to learn, and we are here to rest. We are here to live in this world and meet its problems. If we do so, when time comes for sleep, we will rest well. And when the time comes for a larger sleep that brings with it further opportunities, we'll be ready and carry on as we should. Well, that's it.